From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, it's a conversation with John Biewen and Michael Betts. They're the writers and co-hosts of the latest season of Scene on Radio, a podcast from the Kenan Institute of Ethics at Duke University. This five-part series tackles a topic that's likely familiar for WHQR listeners, the 1898 Wilmington coup and massacre. This show does offer a lot of depth and nuance. Biewen and Betts paint a vivid picture of what was lost in the coup, a cosmopolitan, multiracial city that was thriving as the end of the century approached. And they put the terrifying violence of the massacre in the context of a wider campaign of white supremacist terror that was sweeping across North Carolina. They also work to situate the C word, coup, in the broader lexicon of anti-democratic efforts, which they argue are still ongoing. And lastly, they touch on how a process of healing and restoration might move forward. The two interviewed a lot of people, many of whom you've heard on WHQR before. Lee Ray Umfleet, Cedric Harrison, Bertha Todd, Christopher Everett, Gareth Evans, Kim Cook, Sonia Patrick, Paul Gervais, Kieran Hale, and others. If you haven't heard this series, I do recommend it. Or if you're short on time, there's an hour-long special that encapsulates a lot of the highlights and insights, and you can find links on our show page to all of that. In any case, after my colleagues and I in the newsroom listened to this series, we wanted to talk to the creative team behind it. We wanted to learn about how the show came to be and what Biewen and Betts hope it will do for a conversation that's come a long way in the last 20 years, but perhaps not far enough. And they were generous enough with their time to join me and my colleague Rachel Keith for a long talk about their work and its ramifications. Michael Betts, John Biewen, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, really, Michael and John, for people who don't know who you are, shame on them, but maybe you can give us a quick pocket bio. Michael, starting with you.
Quick pocket bio. I am fortunate enough to be a professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. I'm in the film studies department. Sound is my focus. I'm also an audio producer and a protege to the illustrious John Biewen, who will do a great job of introducing himself. Oh, yeah, I have a three-year-old and a dog and an amazing partner who empower all this stuff.
John Biewen, I am host and producer of the Scene on Radio podcast, S-C-E-N-E on radio. I always hasten to add when I'm talking on the radio. And I work at the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University, which supports the podcast, and I do some teaching at Duke as well.
So my big question to start with is, how did you two get connected and decide that you wanted to do this big project?
So I actually had the great fortune of getting my MFA from Duke University. And on my way in, as I was, you know, studying about the program and whatever, I had stumbled upon John Biewen's podcast and was just completely blown away by the product and what he's capable of pulling off and the people he talks to and his vulnerability as a white person. At that point, seeing white was out as a white person to interrogate himself. And also Mike Wiley, who appears in the show, is a very good friend of mine and was a good friend. And I had done some work for him years prior. And I was like, I got to go talk to this guy because he's doing produced radio the way that I want to do produced radio. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And so reached out to him, got into the program, then reached out to him and said I was going to be coming to the program and would love to talk to him ahead of time. And he was kind enough to entertain my silly shenanigans, came, showed some work. He was very, very complimentary of it and gave me some, you know, tips and whatever. And I said, hey, if you're ever interested, I'd love to help out. And he's like, well, you know, I'll keep it in mind. He goes, but you should think about signing up for my audio class. So I took all the audio things I could take from John while I was in grad school. There's a couple fast-forward iterations. I'm going to skip over the middle section where we become colleagues at the Center for Doc Studies. Anyway, but fast-forward, and Mike Wiley gets named as a visiting artist at the Kenan Institute of Ethics. So Mike Wiley and Charlie Thompson started this initiative called America's Hallowed Ground, where it's going from place to place where atrocities have occurred. And instead of coming in and being like, we're going to make work because you all aren't doing that, we support the artists on the ground who have been doing that labor. So Mike approaches me and says, hey, man, you know, if we're going to start this project, we need to start in Wilmington. It's in our backyard. We have to be honest. The name of the institute is Keenan Institute of Ethics. You know, we have a lot of responsibility that we have to maintain, and we have people we're accountable to be honest, if we're going to start correctly. I said, I'd love to do this. This sounds great, but I can't do this as just a Black individual going into Wilmington. And at that time, I was not here. and so I was like, we need to take a kind of two people approach, one Black, one white. And this is a multiracial coalition kind of thing. And I said, John Biewen would be perfect for this. And so I get on the phone with John, and I'm like halfway through trying to ask him the question. He said, okay, so when are we starting? And John was incredibly quick to it and has been an amazing, like, I've had him as a mentor for years at this point, but the amount of growth method that happened for me during this process has just been overwhelming. And so that's how that's kind of how the thing started.
So I want to ask you guys, here in Wilmington, after over a century of silence on the topic, there has been a lot of coverage of 1898. And so I wonder how you saw your role coming into that kind of world, if whether it was to go more in depth or get everything in one place in like an omnibus series where like here it all is, or just to get this out to a broader audience. What was the mindset there?
I think our approach, Michael, I'm not sure if you'd agree, but my sense is that we weren't terribly concerned with what else had been done. We knew that we weren't, you know, totally breaking new ground here, right? That we were following in the footsteps of other people who had told this story quite effectively from the official state report written by Leray Umfleet, which really to a large extent became almost our Bible for the project, as well as, of course, books, Chris Everett's film, Wilmington on Fire, Tim Tyson's work for the News and Observer, et cetera, that had been a kind of summary. And so it was just a matter of deciding if we're going to do a series, say five episodes in a podcast, what are the most important things to say? And how can we say this as effectively and engagingly as possible? Understanding that while a fair number of people will have been, you know, familiar with those other treatments of the story, a whole bunch of people are not, or they may have heard some kind of brief reference to it and kind of know it happened, but haven't really heard it told in an engaging way. So that we just, let's just do the best we can with, say, five episodes and 3 hours or whatever it was we spent.
Yeah. And really standing on the shoulders of you know, Helen Edmonds and Leon Prather and all the folks, like John said, who came before us was really important in making sure that we saw people and their humanity and knew that we couldn't tell the whole thing. There's so much that's, as much as we know, there's unknown things, and there's things that we will never be able to know. We literally can't know. And so our job was less about trying to make folks focus on us and more about giving folks the opportunity to just interrogate their thinking and go, what else did I not know about this event?
And I want to start, too, with one of the early episodes where you all take us to Wilmington before 1898. And we've heard this story been told before, but I think you all did a really unique retelling of that with historian David Soselsky. And Wilmington was this cosmopolitan area, and we have the ports, and I liked the descriptor of him saying that it was like walking into a Star Wars bar. Like, yeah, that is how unique this place was. And it created people like Senator Abraham Galloway, yeah, but he was not the outlier. He was the norm in this, yeah, Wilmington before 1898.
Yeah, yeah. And for us, I think since the start of this, as we were asking, what are we after? I was like, I was always after trying to tell what we're missing. If we could go there, what are we seeing? I just want to know what we would see. And in the previous November, Mike Wiley had come and the whole America's Hallowed Ground team had come and to Wilmington. And Mike Wiley did a version of his show, The Fire of Freedom. It's the Abraham Galloway story of the same name, the book that Soselsky wrote. And he and Howard Kraft, who wrote the stage play and adapted the stage play, they all had a talkback session after it was over. So it's Howard, it's Mike, and it's David Soselsky, and they're all sitting there. And Howard gets a question asked to him about, like, you know, man, you made this thing really come to life. Like, how did that work? And Howard looks at Soselsky and goes, I mean, he gave me a rubric and it was really easy to follow. I mean, yes, you still got to figure out how to write it in a way that gives us what we're looking for. But Soselsky then just goes and he vamps. And when I tell you, if it had been a rock concert, that's the moment where everybody pulls the lighter out and breaks down at the same time. I was like, we need to talk to that young man right there. And I told John, I said, Soselsky has to open this thing. He has to tell us what we've been missing, because the way he draws these pictures, man, dude, it sends chills down your spine. And so we go in the studio with Soselsky, and it was hilarious because John asks these really poignant questions at that point to get him to just kind of settle in and start the vamp, right? And he just goes, and he's like, tell me about, I think John asked him, he's like, tell me about Abraham Galloway in a way that, how does he fit into this world? And he just opens the world up. And I was like, that's the first episode. Because if we know what we lose, then we know why we're upset. Because yes, there's a lot of black trauma and black destruction from white supremacy that happens in the 19th, 20th, 21st century, right? We know that's an expectation, unfortunately. But to know what we, how we were dispossessed and how we lost ourselves, that's not something that people tend to focus on, because that actually empowers the folks that have been perceived as victims and says they are complicit in their own success, that they fought for their own freedom, that they were capable and very able to be. And so when he does that, I was like, okay, the opening wrote itself. And I told John, I was like, it took forever for that thing to get out of my head. And I gave it to John and I said, I'm sorry it took so long. Well, actually, a lot of this series took a long time, and John did a Herculean effort of being super sweet in rewrites and edits and being kind to me. No, that first episode, though, I told him, I was like, I need this in the world, because I need to know, as a kid who grew up in North Carolina, who were the heroes that I don't know about? And if I could get an action figure, what are the action figures that I'm missing on my shelf? And Abraham Galloway is one of them. And we just run the list, and that was the cool part about that first episode.
One of the things I really like about this series is that you take the time to back up a little bit and give framing sometimes, mm-hmm. Or context. And one time you do that is when you talk about the C word, which I laughed out loud when I was listening to the podcast. So how important was it for you to define the C word, coup? Or as Bertha Todd talks about, you know, when she's talking about the importance of using the word massacre and not sanitizing it with, you know, negative incident or riot or something that misconstrues or misdirects. John, you're on deck for this one.
Yeah, we talked about the definition of the word coup. The context was that we're making the point that although most historians agree there's only been one successful coup d'etat in U.S. history in the literal sense of that word, meaning basically men showed up with guns and made a sitting body of elected officials resign from their jobs at gunpoint and installed a new government, right? That has only happened once in Wilmington, North Carolina, November 10th, 1898. But we were putting that in the larger context of a whole bunch of anti-democratic, undemocratic stuff that has gone on throughout U.S. history. And so we were sort of discussing, well, we don't call it a coup when one party wins control of a state legislature because the state is very heavily gerrymandered, which is happening in the 2020s, right? Or, you know, on and on. Or the fact that black people were not allowed to vote for centuries, or that women were not allowed to vote for the first century and a half of U.S. history, and therefore those elections could not be said to be democratic in the way we would use that word today. And on and on, right? There are many other illustrations of that. Political violence, voter suppression, and in fact, stuff that also went on in 1898, in the 1898 election in North Carolina, which was not the local election or the local incident in Wilmington, but the statewide election, which is now widely seen by historians as having essentially been rigged so that the Democratic Party would take back control from the fusion movement, right? We don't call that a coup, but equally, you know, sort of an anti-democratic seizure of power by one group of people at the expense of another.
Yeah. It became really important to walk folks through. And that was that we actually debated that that got written in, and kudos to John for that. It got written in and cleaned up in a very specific order. And then there was a conversation as to whether that should stay in. And we both felt very passionate about the fact that just because it doesn't qualify as a coup doesn't mean it's not coup-like. Doesn't mean like it doesn't, you know, it's got the smell of, if I can quote Roy Wood Jr., you know, it's got the residue of racism, you know, like it's got this smell attached to it that's just like something doesn't feel right about this. And so anti-democratic work, just straight up fascist ideas, right? Those are things that we don't define by that word, but could easily qualify if we were to be less restrictive. But it's not that word. There are other words. Gerrymandering is another, you know what I mean? Like really giving folks a lecture, and not, well, not a lecture, it was just a lesson, saying like, think about all these other things that are still doing the same kind of labor, but it's not that.
And I think that's unpacking it more than just flattening it so that anything we don't like from one part of the political spectrum is fascism. Like right. It's actually looking at, let's open the hood, right? And this might, it looks like a Ford or a Lincoln, but like you open the hood, like, oh, hey, that's the same stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Another time you guys sort of pulled back the camera, and I really appreciate this because this is so much above and beyond the usual disclosure notice, right? Was when you got into the family of William Rand Kenan, whose family's, you know, philanthropic donations made the Kenan Institute for Ethics possible. I mean, that is a hell of a disclosure notice, but really eye-opening.
Yeah. John, I think you, this is your heroic act. I'm going to just say how I was like, yeah, that sounds great, but you got to do that one.
Well, we knew from the start, and everybody at the Kenan Institute for Ethics was on board, including the director, David Toole, who, you know, ultimately had to sign off on everything that we did, that we had to own, and that in fact this was an opportunity for the Kenan Institute to own the story of William Rand Kenan Sr. And I'll just try to do a very brief summary. He lived in Wilmington, was a successful merchant in his 50s, and he was the captain of a squad that ran a machine gun, essentially, a Colt machine gun, sort of like the Gatling guns that we picture from that era, that could fire 400 rounds a minute. And that gun was taken into, it was a Wilmington Light Infantry, which was a local militia. It was their gun and their squad. The gun was taken into the city during the massacre of November 10th. And there is some blurriness around exactly what that gun squad and the gun did, but there have been reports that in one case that they shot up to 25 people down, black men, at one street corner, and there was a lot of talk afterwards about people who were proud of the massacre and the alleged putting down of a riot by black people, that this gun squad had done heroic work. William Rand Kenan Sr. was the captain of that gun squad. He is not the namesake of the Kenan Institute for Ethics, but members of his family, relatives of his, are and to this day are part of, you know, family's trust that continues to fund the Kenan Institute. So we just needed to put that out there in a very direct fashion and own it is how we saw it. So we spent a decent amount of time in episode 3 discussing all of that.
Yeah, even more so his son, in the problems of the autobiography that he rewrites, his son literally says, like, my dad was there. And so we're like, I'm paraphrasing, but he says my father was there, you know? And so it becomes even more kind of cementing, like, yeah, we know you were there. There's a photo of you after the fact. Like, we need to own that. If we're going to be using money that has any semblance of your name attached to it, we need to own that and be honest with it.
And two, I want to talk about a really interesting idea that you also tackle pretty early on in the series, is that Wilmington was the norm, not the exception post-Reconstruction. Can you talk about that evolution and how you got the sources to talk about that idea?
Yeah. It's really funny. So, you know, probably day 2 or 3 of this idea being whipped up, you know, John and I are talking and I was like, and then we got to figure out, you know, how does Wilmington manage to make it? Like, it's, and he's like, yeah, you know, it's this beacon of what, you know, it's here. How does it work? And you know, why is it still in existence 20 years after the quote unquote end of Reconstruction? Why is Wilmington still this fortress and stronghold effectively for multiracial democracy, for enfranchisement, for, you know, wealth building, all of these things? Why is, you know, and so we're framing it that way. And so we go get our questions together, and we go and talk to Dr. William Sturkey at the point where he, right before he left from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and went to UPenn. We ask him that question, and he gives us that line of, like, I push back on that reading because it's a very pessimistic reading, and it assumes that white supremacy's win is inevitable. And he's like, you can't do that. And we actually have Adrienne Lynn Smith echoes this. She's like one of our, like, we get a, like a sandwich. So we start our interviews with that, and we end our interviews with, like, be careful of the word inevitability in the world of history, because nothing's inevitable until it is. And it's just like, oh, we are making assumptions from this side of the view about how it was being perceived at that moment. And it really changed our perception, because he basically said, Dr. Sturkey said, like, it was the law of the land that multiracial democracy should be set forth, that people should be enfranchised, that we should be seeing all of these things as they are. And Wilmington was doing that labor. And there was a cosmopolitan world by which to erect that scenario and put it in place. And it was precisely because of how lodged in it was and how effective it was being in this community that the only way to disenfranchise people, to destroy the political and the economic standing of the Black community, and to destroy the social construction of the Black community was to coup and was to massacre, because they could not in any other way pull that community apart without taking it and forcibly doing so.
I'm going to give you guys permission to punt on this question if you want, because it is not about your work. But I have to ask, have either of you seen the John Locke-produced film In the Pines?
Oh, man.
And for listeners who don't know, this is a fictionalized version of the 1898 massacre in Wilmington, paired with a love story for reasons. And it is, among other things, very insistent on the historically true fact that this was perpetrated by the Democratic Party. And I think if you played a drinking game where you took a shot every time they said Democrat, you would die of liver failure before the film was over.
Yeah.
So I got to wonder, as someone who is on a different path but with the same goal of recreating 1898, have you seen this? What do you think about this?
John, have you seen it yet?
I have not seen it. I've read a little bit about it.
I've read a lot about it because it's on the festival circuit and it's being kept in very specific places. So I haven't had the opportunity to see it. My understanding is that it won't come here.
That's what I've heard, yes.
And I do think you're right to drive home the notion of the democratic nature of things and to take the focus off of who was harmed and make it far more about this sitting on. It's kind of like the War of Northern Aggression all over again, where we frame it as something that it wasn't, because we want to draw like smoke and mirrors away from what actually was the very impactful thing, aka the coup and the massacre. The one thing that I would say out loud with no hesitation, without having seen it but having read as much as I have, there was somebody who did fiction, who fictionalized that event. It happened in 1902, Charles Chestnut's text. And that's the fictionalization that makes the most sense.
The marrow of tradition.
The marrow of tradition is the fictionalization that makes sense. Largely because if you're going to add things that are side stories, B stories, C stories, whatever, you can't shy away from the A story. And I think that that's, you can say all the things you want to say about In the Pines. They shy away from the A story. And that's always going to be, I'll leave it right there.
It's diplomatic.
Yes.
Okay. So another question I had for you both was, over the last, I think, 6 years, I spent a lot of time talking to Kent Chatfield, who is one of the researchers for Wilmington on Fire and a bunch of other projects. He's done a lot of research, which I've never had the opportunity to vet out, but he's showed me some of his work from the logbooks of the U.S. Army, from the archive. And his working thesis is that the United States Army was involved, basically in collecting black soldiers from southeastern North Carolina, moving them first to the Outer Banks and then Tennessee and then to a work camp in Georgia. And he also tracked actually the provenance of that Colt repeating rifle that you were talking about from a naval warship that was involved in the war in the Caribbean.
Yep.
And so I'm wondering that he did make a film about that. It briefly showed here in Wilmington, and then it sort of went away. And I know there were some maybe some interpersonal issues with the production team. But I'm curious if you looked at any of that research, thought about including it, thought maybe, hey, this isn't vetted out all the way, or how you thought about that.
I think that LeRae actually gave us some of that where the Colt gun had come from. That element is in a lot of our research. Just because we're trying to, if you're trying to track the path, prime example is like, on Sixth and Bladen, there's a tree there that's been there for forever. And I'm saying this on purpose so that it's archived. So if that tree ever comes down, LeRae M. Fleet, myself, and a whole team of researchers would like to take that tree. Do not just give us the tree, please, because we think that we would find casings and bullets in the tree because that tree's been there. But to the point, I think that you know, we're interested in being able to actually, if I can say, the genealogy of that gun, right? To see that it was actually at that intersection that it was fired, because there's some dispute as to whether or not the gun actually did fire. That's part of the reason why we have to say, according to the research, this is what we know, because the case or the, and John, please correct me if I'm wrong, the footnote that is in Harry Hayden's text, what does that footnote say about the 25 people that that gun potentially killed?
Well, what LeRae explained to us was that he had written earlier drafts where he said they shot 25 men. They killed 25 men at that intersection, and then ultimately in the last draft. This is, I believe this is the case, then changed the story to say that they shot one or two. I forget what the number was.
So that part of the research is something that we definitely looked at. The remainder of it, one, it was outside of the scope of where we were trying to stay. And the second is, I would be interested in being able to have, I didn't get a chance to talk to Mr. Chatfield. That would be kind of stuff that it would be interesting to be able to bring in and be able to set it up next to itself, you know, set it up next to itself. Again, this story is never over. It's never over. There's so many iteratives of so many spinoffs, if we can say it's a multiverse, right? There's people whose lives are changed indefinitely, and we'll never get to the bottom of it. So yeah, that's a story for season whatever, episode 79, you know, like where we go through that.
Well, speaking of another situation like that, in David Sacchino's Pulitzer Prize book on 1898, Wilmington's Lie, rightfully so, that book deserved that, was well written. It deserved that accomplishment. But I couldn't get over a paragraph in the epilogue, and okay, I want to read it to you all. It says, quote, "The report also challenged an enduring black myth that whites seized the property of hundreds of black residents who fled after the coup. Based on a detailed study of deeds and tax records by Sue Ann Cody, the commission found no evidence of widespread property seizures. Wilmington's whites sought to rob blacks of their civil rights, not their property," end quote.
I see what the question is. So I will answer based off of things that I read, and John, please jump in on things that you read and in interviews that we had. So one of those folks that we talked to is the descendant of the, I think it's the People's Perpetual Municipal Bank or People's Perpetual Trust Savings Loan or something like that. It's the bank. And Inez Campbell Eason, she shows up in episode 5. And when she was showing me the records of things that had existed, it's very evident that there's a lot of money that's transferring hands that's existing in the black community. And as a matter of fact, when they set up that particular bank, there's an ad that goes in the paper where they're like, "Attention all white men. The Negroes are setting up a bank. We need to have a conversation about it." Again, paraphrasing, but that's effectively what it says. And so they get together and discuss, like, what does this mean for us kind of deal? And I think I heard it said this way, and this is where it's best laid in this way. We may not have evidence directly saying that X person did X thing to take X property, But if you run people out of town and then say that the property is delinquent on property taxes, which then gives you access to take and seize said property, you are effectively still doing the same thing. So could we say that it was about trying to take back property? I don't know that we can say that. Could we say that the end result is about taking back property? I think we can say that full-throatedly.
Yeah, I think you interview Kim Cook, who's a professor at UNCW, who makes the point that the legal story here might be that there's no evidence for that, but the moral story, you know, the human story is that there was a thriving black middle class with people like Inez's great-great-grandfather, who was not just the president of a bank, but on the board of two other banks.
Yeah, three banks in total.
Three banks.
That's... And is an energy – I mean, yes, he's carting coal from place to place, but he's an energy producer. He's sending – you need coal for your house to burn. And a lot of those companies, those little single – they become energy conglomerates. If you follow what that money does in those families that are allowed to do that, that's, again, generational wealth and how it's handed off.
I mean, the story here, I'll get back to this issue in a little bit, but the story here is compounded interest.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, exactly. So put a pin in that.
All right.
John, anything to add on that?
I would just say, I mean, yeah, that Kim Cook's point about the legal truth and the moral truth, it's almost analogous to the coup itself, by which the men came with guns and they insisted that each member of the city council, the assembly, resign. And then as each one resigned, then the remainder of the board, quote unquote, elected the next new member. And this was following the city charter, that there was a process by which they could replace a member that way by a vote of the council itself, right? So you could sort of say, well, legal. So it was all done above board. It was all legal. Well, except that as Lee Ray Umfleet says, there were a bunch of guns pointed at them when they did this. So that all changes the moral truth a whole lot.
Yeah, if I take $100 out of the ATM and give it to the guy who has a Glock to my head, I don't know if I would say I gave him.
Yeah, we wouldn't use that word.
Yeah.
we might say coerce.
We probably would say. You know,
there's more precise language that we would use.
We might say under duress.
Under duress, exactly.
And Michael, I wanted to see if you wanted to weigh in on this, but I followed the book ban in Hanover County Schools for close to a year, and that was the book written, adapted from Ibram X. Kendi's Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism in You, written by Jason Reynolds. Yeah. And I wanted to get your thoughts because following that, when I listened to the series, you talked to Dr. Sturkey, correct, of UPenn, and he said even after 1898, you couldn't write a history that made white people feel upset.
Right.
And this kind of reoccurred with this book on race.
Oh, man. Book bans are hard in many ways. I think anytime we are willing to tell a willfully wrong historical tale, and I say historical tale because there's your history, my history, and the history, right? So I get we have positionality that may change how we understand what happened. But if we are willfully removing bits and pieces of the historical record, eventually, if history is the house that we all live in, the house collapses because there's nothing holding it together. You're missing gigantic chunks and boards. And what ends up happening is we perpetrate the same things and the same atrocities all over again because we think we're doing something inventive. And we don't actually know that we're walking in the same footsteps as our ancestors have, or our forefathers, if I will say, have before us. And so I think for me, one of the things that is most gnarly about a book ban, first and foremost, is the specificity. It's not allowed to be in the classroom. It can stay in the library, but it can't be in the classroom. Well, coming from a vat of educators, my partner was previously an educator. I was an educator before I did college. I was with first graders. And one of the things that was really noticeable and notable about students in their curiosity is whatever happens in the library, you may pull a book and you may never have an interest to actually read it. You might just think it's a really cool thing to carry around. But if you can get that book back to my classroom, or you can get a book off the shelf in my classroom,
I can make that thing come alive for you. And it's just, it's the cinder that needs to be lit. And then you'll finish out. You'll burn it all, you know, and you'll be so enraptured by this text that it will inform things about you later. I have so many examples of that when I was a kid and I would read and I would have a teacher sit down with me and be like, dude, you gotta check this out, this thing right here that happened. And, you know, does Redwall hold up today? No. But, you know, like, I remember as a kid being so excited about those texts. And so I think it needs to come into the classroom for a myriad of reasons. But one is that's labor that needs to sit on adults to contextualize for, I don't care if you're in high school. Like, you are going to need someone who to look to and say, this thing is heavy. Help me figure out how to hold this weight. And we see it all the time in other communities. The Holocaust gets taught with no problem. We start really, really early to make sure that we understand the impact of the Holocaust over time. In certain Muslim communities, you'll hear stories of like atrocities that have occurred because you want to make sure that you know it your whole life over. And it doesn't frame how you see people. It understands and allows you to frame how history sees you. And that's really the big thing. That's the big takeaway. So for me, I'm so disappointed is not even the right word. I'm just disheartened. Like, we shouldn't have all the book banning, the libraries do like national book banning weeks where we like go and intentionally read banned books and like celebrate and whatever. What's funny is folks that are banning the text, if you didn't make a big deal out of it, no one would care.
I have made this point to some of the conservatives in this region privately that if they, and they're usually my age, I'm 42, so if they're my age, then they grew up with Tipper Gore trying to take away hip hop and heavy metal from us by putting that sticker on it. That sticker made that CD a commodity.
It was cool.
It was so cool.
It was cool.
You had to have it.
And to get Twisted Sister in the same room with, I don't know, you had was it Frank Zappa, Twisted Sister, and... I think like Heavy D and the Boys, all like they're all sitting there being like, we all are saying the same message. We have the opportunity to have these really deep, dense discussions, and it's art. Like, you gonna go back and edit out, which they tried to do, but like Faulkner's work, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's it's art. We are working through something.
And I wanted to add, too, because I did my due diligence. I talked to all sides, and I talked to the parent who got the book successfully removed, and I talked to the head of the GOP as well. And even if you look at Phil Berger, he is standing behind Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson when he unveils his indoctrination in public schools report in August of 2021. Mm-hmm. They all say, teach the history. But that has no bearing on what we are looking at today in the 21st century in 2024. That is their argument when I try to ask, because they also try to say, we want to learn about this history, but we don't want to hear how it's connected to what we're seeing today in our own lives.
And I think that that's, you can tell me that you want to learn how to run, but you are opposed to standing up. Those things are diametrically opposed to each other. I can't teach you. I can show you the mechanics of how running works. But if you don't stand up, we're never going to be able to take the first step. It's just trying to, like, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. If you are actually earnestly interested in hearing how the history plays out, then you're actively earnestly interested in how it impacts today's world. Because we live in the shadow of yesterday. We live in the shadow of yesterday. If, heaven help, a meteor hits the other side of the earth, it might not be tomorrow, but it's getting here by, what, today's Monday? It'll be here by, you know, Wednesday or the day after or whatever, right? And so I just think that we have to be mindful of the ripple. We're all interconnected. There's no way to disjointedly do that. And I think and this is something that John and I both ran into. There were conversations about that we would bump into where people were afraid that they were going to be held accountable for the past. And what does it mean to be held accountable for the past? I think that's the first question that we really need to ask. And if we want to learn the history in full, maybe that happens. But we got to learn the history in full first. And everybody has to agree that we're all working from the same textbooks, because we're not all working from the same textbooks. And I think that there are plenty of people who would listen to what John and I put together and go, that feels like a lot of opinion. There's not a whole lot of fact to back that up. And I'll be like, I don't know what else to show you. Like, I feel like there is a connection between the coup that nobody got in trouble for and the coup that happened, or the attempt that happened on January 6th. I can't not see those connections. Those are pretty deep.
We are in such an interesting time as a country, and it can be very dispiriting to see things like book bans and laws passed in Florida with names like the Anti-Woke Act. I think I'm getting that right.
Yes, that's right.
But I actually think, I mean, it's indicative of of a kind of growth pain, I think. When we did the Seeing White series back in 2017 on Seen on Radio, which is the series that the show is best known for, we opened that series by talking about the fact that Americans are sort of notorious for not caring much about history. Like, I'm quoting myself here. We Americans are notorious for not knowing or caring about history. We care a whole lot more about tomorrow. Forget yesterday. Yeah. Yesterday was so long ago, for one thing. Get over it. And I think that that's less true today than it was 7-8 years ago. We're actually having a bunch of fights about history now in our culture. And I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a backlash to increasing efforts by people to tell a truer version of U.S. history, more warts and all, a clearer presentation about the pervasiveness of white supremacy in the founding and the growth of the country as a prime example. And so then you get this huge pushback, which is Tucker Carlson on Fox News saying they're trying to make you feel bad for being white, and the anti-CRT movement and the anti-wokeness movement, and let's ban books and so on. So let's fire teachers who say the wrong thing in class. Part of me wants to see something positive in the form of a kind of growth pain. It's like, oh, well, at last, in a certain sense, we as Americans are really wrestling with these things, and it ain't pretty. And the pushback is, as I say, disheartening, the strength of it and the backlash and the insistence on staying in denial about our history. But maybe the pushback was inevitable. And I guess the good news is that in some ways, you know, that we're having these fights rather than not.
And I can attest, in April of 2023, there was a town hall with the school board.
Yeah.
And a parent got up of a third grader and said to the board, hey, my third grader is learning about racism and the civil rights movement, and this is totally inappropriate. And one of the board members said, absolutely, that is so inappropriate. We should not be doing that. You should tell us when you find out issues like this. But then in this mostly white audience, there was a black constituent who stood up and said, hey, y'all, I experienced racism when I was in third grade. I just wanted to say that. And then he went on to his question to the board. So I witnessed this kind of play out in the public square not too long ago.
Yeah. And the downside is oftentimes, and we talk about this, you know, there's the black tax and the brown tax and the pink tax, right? Depending on the world that we're talking about, black and brown people have the labor of always working out everyone else's trauma, typically white individuals and like their victimhood therein, right? Women have the job of working out men's problems and our victimhood and the things that we're struggling through. And then on top of that, however that impacts you as you get home at the end of the day, in my line of work, all the folks that have, you know, the ability to not be concerned about students that have racial issues or that are dealing with misogyny, they get to do more labor. They get to write more books. They get to, you know, make more films because they're not handling the labor of those harmed humans. And it's the same thing here. We're talking about a book being banned that is to help make the community safer for people to come into who aren't the white folks in the world. And if they don't feel that it is safe for them to have to be here, and the black constituent has to do the labor of standing up and being like, hey, let me remind you that I've experienced this. It's not theoretical. In the same way that patriarchy and misogyny is not theoretical, racism is not theoretical. Like, there are things that people have actually experienced. If you're a disability advocate and someone looks at you and says, stand up, get out of your wheelchair, that's not a theoretical abuse. That's actually happening to you in real time. And it's frustrating that the people who experience the harm, on average, the individuals who have to inform everybody, hey, I've been harmed. What are we going to do about this?
I want to bring it back to this series. And some of the pushback that you guys talked about that you call white lash
mm-hmm.
sometimes, because Lord knows we have heard some of that here at the station. There are some people who just, they may paper over what they're saying with a particular complaint about this feels opinionated or this felt one-sided or whatever the, but you can sense that the real complaint is, I do not want to hear about this.
Yeah.
Why am I hearing about this? We have gotten quite a bit of that. Another critique we get, and I hear this from the Black community sometimes, is that in a largely white media world, this has become a form of like pain pornography.
Yeah.
Or kind of like a ritual of white self-flagellation. So we let ourselves off the hook. We talked about 1898, and then it's over.
Yep.
It's like a Freudian magical therapy, right? Like, you're cured.
Right.
We talked about the bad thing. Now we're cured. And you get into this in episode 5.
Right.
So that's why I want to take this conversation at the end here. Is that the criticism of that is that it ends the story when it's starting, right? It doesn't get into, as you kind of talk about, all the things Black people have done to be the agents of their own liberation,
right?
And all of the very real systemic generational damage that is still out there.
Right.
It's all still on the table, and we haven't even started talking about that in therapy yet.
Right.
Right? So why was it so important to really get to that part of the story for you guys?
What's funny is the way that the original script was written, John and I had some back and forth and we were talking about it. And John was like, tell me about this part. And I told him, and I said, we need to include that because the first part is for the white people and then the second part is for the Black people. And John said, well, why don't you just say that? And I was like, oh, I guess I'm allowed to say that out loud in that way. And to your point, so why do we need to get there? It was really important to me to not let this traffic in pornography of trauma and pain. I wanted for everything this piece is about harm that happened to the Black community here in Wilmington and writ large. It's not just Wilmington. It's the state of North Carolina. It's the United States. It's global. It has this ripple effect, right? So for everything that this was, I needed Black individuals to be the agents who were in control of the narrative, that they were the ones who were able to push back against the pushback. Because if you go outside, we're in Wilmington, you go outside, you can see the impact. I can go for long periods of time without seeing somebody who looks like me walking around. It is very unnerving, I'll be very honest with you.
Yeah, our Black community in Wilmington is smaller than the state and national average and segregated by and large certain neighborhoods.
Yeah.
In a way that you could say happens in the South, but it does. I've talked to people who've lived in Charlotte and then moved back here. People who were born here moved to Atlanta, moved back, and they'll tell you it feels different. Wilmington hits different.
I mean, and part of that, I think, is exactly what Bertha Todd gets at. We need to lance a wound. And like that's part of the work we're doing is trying to be a part of that lance that goes in and pulls that disease out of the body. But the only way that you can do that is to really face the thing, to handle the work, but also to give credit to the people who were doing the labor the whole time. And if we don't do that, then we're telling a one-sided story. We're telling a misnarrative. And I think that was really a big part of this for me, was to make sure that the community that's been on the ground this whole time, and Chris Everett's going to do it with Wilmington on Fire too, like the folks that have been here fighting the good fight, they've never left. And it's not that they were erased from history. They've just decided that they're going to remove themselves from public view. Because if they're willing to harm you in the street, they'll harm you in the shadows, right? So I'll just pull myself back. I'll do this work over here that keeps my family alive, that strengthens the community. But I don't need to necessarily tell everybody. We don't need to put it on the front page of the newspaper all the time. And so I think that there's this kind of push and shove, I think, is the best way to answer that question. Why was it important? It's to give the push and shove. All right. The first part of the push is white folks need to be doing these things. The shove is, how is it impacting you? The first part of the push is Black folks need to be reading about their own liberation. The shove, how does that impact you? And that kind of push and shove, that push and pull, puts in perspective an opportunity for folks to be complicit with their own education, with their own movement towards a better tomorrow. Like, I know that feels incredibly idealistic, but John actually did a really great job, because episode 4 actually read, the original script of that read incredibly pessimistic. And it was John who was like, listen here, young man, like,
let me be your mentor for 2 minutes and pick you up and realize, get you to understand, like, you're fighting the fight. And there's all these other examples where the fight is being fought. Don't feel that the burden of existence is so great that you'll ever be crushed. A friend of mine who's on death row right now said to me, and this is one of the reasons that my child is alive today. He said to me, he said, we've never before been harmed by the impact of all that mess over there. And if you choose not to have this black baby because you're afraid of what the world would do to that child, you let them win.
Yeah. So here's my last question for you. I think whether or not you use the words, we're talking about truth and reconciliation.
Yeah.
And sometimes people leave the term restitution off of that.
I might push a little bit because Kim Cook actually says this in a part of the interview we didn't include. She says truth and restoration, because you can't reconcile that which was not. There was already a mismatch in the black and black community and in the white community. So we need to restore that brief moment before everything goes nuts.
So that's what I want to ask about.
Yeah.
So I feel like part of doing that is acknowledging that.
Right.
Right. And talking about that and detailing it in ways that hold up under scrutiny.
Yeah.
Which I think, I mean, you and John have been doing the work of that. But there is another part of it of like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
And this is the point at which some people will turn the radio off when we talk about reparations, when we talk about actually getting into the nitty-gritty, granular, what was lost.
And if you say white, that's also a turn-off.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, that is, you know, some of these conversations have started to happen in places like Asheville.
Yeah.
You know, which has its own nasty history of racial violence. But when we're actually going to get into and talk about, like, what was lost and what would it take to actually, I think you say, maybe not make it fine, but like make it less bad.
Yeah. Yeah. John, do you want to take the first part of this?
Yeah, I think really an important thrust of the last episode, episode 5, was that it's not enough.
Yeah.
Acknowledgement is incredibly important, and that the century of silence and lies about what happened in 1898, it's very important that we overcome that and get the truth about what happened widely known and understood, right? That's an absolutely essential step, but it's not the end. It's not the end of our responsibility as journalists, and it's not the end of yeah. of our responsibility as a society.
Right.
And so that's why we spend a bunch of time in that episode talking about what would it mean. But to not to make it right, really, because that's impossible, but to make it less wrong, right? To try to restore, to give back some of what was taken, you know, as much as possible, to get back to where you could try to move forward. Because it's sort of like, you know, you're running a race and you've knocked people down 20 times and run away from them, and now you're going to stop knocking them down. Well, no, that's not enough. You right. need to start the race over, right?
Right.
Take some steps to bring those folks up alongside of you, so then you can move forward together. So we talk about reparations among other things. Absolutely.
And to come back to something that you said, we're going to put a pin in.
Yeah,
it's
time for compound interest.
And the problem of any version of reparations that we're going to do, it will never be able to take into consideration compound interest and all the random offshoots. We could be sitting right here, and as you know, we end this conversation and we're just talking and be like, you know, it'd be really great. What if we did a podcast about such and such? And then all of a sudden we come up with an idea, we do the story, we get people in, and it grows and it does its own thing. We will never know all of the B, C, D, E, F storylines that would have existed had Wilmington been able to soldier on. Because we didn't get to see them. They were disrupted in the A storyline.
Wilmington could be the capital of the United States.
Literally. And yeah. like that's the kind of stuff that we would never you can't imagine it, because you don't know what you don't know. As somebody who is big into and folks, it's showing up. As somebody who's huge into comic books, like there's other storylines, right? We in DC, or excuse me, in Marvel, we refer to this world as Earth 616, right? This whole idea of there are other worlds, there are other iterations, there are other versions of people on another universe and another planet having this exact same conversation, and we're different. I'm interviewing you all, like
in the HBO Watchmen universe,
right?
Yeah.
So we don't know what we don't know, and I think that that's more to your point. Yes, we can give money back. Yes, we should, right? Yes, we can give property back, and we should, right? Yes, we can we can try as hard as possible to reimagine a world that could have been closer to what would have happened. But all of the people who died who never had the children who were going to be the doctors, all the people who died of poverty who never got an opportunity to become the icon, we don't know who those people are. And that is the most devastating part of this whole discussion. So when we talk about compound interest, that's compound human interest, that's compound social interest, that's compound financial interest.
I think sometimes people balk at the idea that if you look at like a civil case where someone is injured and they lose the use of their legs,
yeah,
or the ability to enjoy their life or work, ply their trade or do their art, juries come back with huge,
gigantic sums,
gigantic awards. And that in and of itself is kind of shocking because it's, you know, we're talking tens of millions of dollars.
Let's just look at a most recent defamation case.
But I think what's interesting is that if you look at those transcripts, you'll hear the jury and the judge say, this is a token offering. This doesn't come close. So those, you know, eight figure settlements, that's saying like, there's no way that we could ever reimburse, quote unquote, you for what you've lost. This is the best we can do.
Right. Well, and how could we know the value of a human life? Much less the value of a limb or more than that, you know? And I think that if we say we are actually, this is one of the things, and I do want to say this, and maybe we close, but I do want to say when folks say, well, it's wholly un-American for us to continue the story, right? It's wholly un-American for us to have a conversation where we do handouts. It's wholly un-American for us to be racist in these ways. I was like, no. Let's go. We don't have to go that far in the historical record. And we can look at what's going on today. Part of the reason why the history matters is because precedent is how legal stuff is set, right? This is one of the reasons why I think Dr. Cook's statement of the legal and moral impact is really important, because just because you can legally get away with it doesn't mean you should. I don't have to legally give you a piece of property that my great ancestor stole from you or your family. I don't have to legally give that back to you. There might be a conversation that I should morally do it, because not only will it make it less bad and less wrong, but you need to have an opportunity to thrive in the way that you were supposed to.
All right. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for this series. And we will have made it clear at the top of the show, but this conversation is in no way a substitute for listening to this 5-part series, or at the very least, the one part episode that, you know, encapsulates some of it. That is mandatory listening, I think is fair to say. But for now, John and Michael, thank you. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for this project that you worked on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Our thanks to John Biewen and Michael Betts. And, of course, thanks to my colleague, Rachel Keith. Thanks also to the WHQR technical team, Ken Campbell and Mark Breedy. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast. If you have thoughts, concerns, issues, questions, hate mail, or an idea for a future show, that's my personal favorite, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.